He half closed the casements of his window, but a moment later the knight said no, and with a kind of wide-eyed insistence, disdaining blows, entered again. I was so tickled to learn that Tanya has a little girl, and I'm terribly glad for her and for you. The other day I wrote Tanya a long lyrical letter, but I have an uncomfortable feeling that I put the wrong address on it. Instead of 122, I put some other number without thinking, just as I did once before. I don't know why this happens. One writes an address heaps of times, automatically and correctly, and then all of a sudden one hesitates. One looks at it consciously, and one sees you're not sure of it. It seems unfamiliar. Very queer. You know, like taking a simple word, say, ceiling, C-E-I-L-I-N-G, and seeing it as ceiling, S-E-A-L-I-N-G, or ceiling, S-E-A-L-I-N-G, until it becomes completely strange and feral, something like Iceling or Inglisi. I think that someday that will happen to the whole of life. In any case, wish Tanya for me everything gay, green, and leshinosummery. Tomorrow my landlord and landlady are going away, and I'm beside myself with joy. Beside myself. A very pleasant situation, like on a rooftop at night. I'll stay at Agamemnonstrasse another month and then move. I don't know how things will work out. By the way, my Chernyshevsky is selling rather well. Who exactly was it told you that Bunyan praised it? They already seem ancient history to me now, my exertions over the book, and all those little storms of thought, those cares of the pen. And now I am completely empty, clean, and ready to receive new lodgers. You know, I'm black as a gypsy from the Grunewald sun. Something is beginning to take shape. I think I'll write a classical novel with types, love, fate, conversations. The door suddenly opened. Zena half entered, and without letting go of the door handle, threw something on his desk. "Pay this to Mama," she said. She glanced at him through slitted eyes and disappeared. He unfolded the banknote. 200 marks. The amount seemed colossal, but a moment's calculation showed that it would only just suffice for the 2 past months. 80 plus 80, and 35 for the coming one, from now on without board. But everything grew confused when he began to consider that for the past month he had not been taking lunch, but on the other hand had been receiving bigger suppers. Besides that, he had contributed during that time 10 or 15 marks, and on the other hand, he owed for telephone conversations and for one or two other trifles, such as today's taxi. The solution to the problem was beyond him. It bored him. He thrust the money beneath a dictionary. And with descriptions of nature, "I'm very glad that you're reading my thing over again, but now it's time to forget it. It was only an exercise, a tryout, an essay before the school holidays. I have missed you a great deal, and perhaps, I repeat, I don't know how it'll work out, I'll visit you in Paris. Generally speaking, I'd abandon tomorrow this country, oppressive as a headache, where everything is alien and repulsive to me, where a novel about incest or some brash trash, some cloyingly rhetorical, pseudo-brutal tale about war, is considered the crown of literature, where in fact there is no literature and hasn't been for a long time, where, sticking out of the fog of a most monotonous democratic dampness, also pseudo, you have the same old jackboot and helmet, where our native and forced social intent in literature has been replaced by social opportunity, and so on and so on. I could go on much longer. And it is amusing that 50 years ago every Russian thinker with a suitcase used to scribble exactly the same, an accusation so obvious as to have become even banal. Earlier, on the other hand, in the golden middle of last century, goodness, what transports! Little gemütlich Germany. Ach, brick cottages. Ach, the kiddies go to school. Ach, the peasant doesn't beat his horse with a club. Never mind. He has his own German way of torturing it, in a cozy nook with red-hot iron. Yes, I would have left long ago, but there are certain personal circumstances, not to mention my wonderful solitude in this country, the wonderful beneficent contrast between my inner habitus and the terribly cold world around me. You know, in cold countries, houses are warmer than in the South, better insulated and heated. But even these personal circumstances are capable of taking such a turn that soon, perhaps, I'll leave the Fetterland and bring them with me. And when will we return to Russia? What idiotic sentimentality! What a rapacious groan must our innocent hope convey to people in Russia! But our nostalgia is not historical, only human. How can one explain this to them? It's easier for me, of course, than for another to live outside Russia, because I know for certain that I shall return. First, because I took away the keys to her, and secondly, because no matter when, in 100, 200 years, I shall live there in my books, or at least in some researcher's footnote. There. Now you have a historical hope, a literary historical one. I lust for immortality, even for its earthly shadow. Today I'm writing you non-stop nonsense, non-stop trains of thought, because I'm well and happy, and besides that, all this has something to do in a roundabout way with Tanya's baby. The literary review you ask about is called The Tower. I don't have it, but I think you'll find it in any Russian bookshop. Nothing came from Uncle Olek. When did he send it? I think you've mixed something up. Well, that's it. Keep well. Je t'embrasse. Night. Rain quietly falling. It has found its nocturnal rhythm and can now go on for infinity. He heard the hall fill with departing voices, heard somebody's umbrella fall, and the elevator summoned by Zena rumble and come to a halt. All was still again. Fyodor went into the dining room where Shchogolev sat cracking the last nuts, chewing on one side, and Mariana Nikolaevna was clearing the table. Her plump, dark pink face, the glossy wings of her nose, violet eyebrows, apricot hair turning to bristly blue on her fat-shaven nape, her azure orb with its mascara-fouled canthus momentarily immersing its gaze in the dreggy ooze on the bottom of the teapot, her rings, her garnet brooch, the flowery shawl on her shoulders, all this together constituted a crudely but richly daubed picture in a somewhat hackneyed genre. She put on her spectacles and took out a sheet with figures on it when Fyodor asked how much he owed her. At this, Shchogolev raised his eyebrows in surprise. He'd been sure that they would not get another penny from their lodger, and being essentially a kindly man, he had advised his wife only yesterday not to press Fyodor, but to write him a week or two later from Copenhagen with a threat to approach his relatives. After settling up, Fyodor retained 3.5 marks out of the 200 and went off to bed. In the hallway, he met Zena returning from below. "Well," she said, holding her finger on the switch, a half-interrogative, half-urging interjection, which meant approximately, "Are you coming this way? I'm putting out the light here, so hurry up." The dimple on her naked arm, pale silk-clad legs in velvet slippers, lowered face, darkness. He went to bed and began to fall asleep to the whisper of the rain. As always, on the border between consciousness and sleep, all sorts of verbal rejects, sparkling and tinkling, broke in. The crystal crunching of that Christian night beneath the chrysolytic star. And his thought, listening for a moment, aspired to gather them and use them, and began to add of its own, extinguished Yasnaya Polyana's light, and Pushkin dead, and Russia far. But since this was no good, the stipple of rhymes extended further. A falling star, a cruising chrysolite, an aviator's avatar. His mind sank lower and lower into a hell of alligator alliterations, into infernal cooperatives of words. Through their nonsensical accumulation, a round button on the pillowcase prodded him in the cheek. He turned on his other side, and against a dark backdrop, naked people ran into the Grunewald Lake, and a monogram of light resembling an infusorian glided diagonally to the highest corner of his subpalpebral field of vision. Behind a certain closed door in his brain, holding on to its handle but turning away from it, his mind commenced to discuss with somebody a complicated and important secret. But when the door opened for a minute, it turned out that they were talking about chairs, tables, stables. Suddenly, in the thickening mist, by Reason's last toll gate, came the silver vibration of a telephone bell, and Fyodor rolled over prone, falling. The vibration stayed in his fingers, as if a nettle had stung him. In the hall, having already put back the receiver into its black box, stood Zina. She seemed frightened. "That was for you," she said in a low voice. "Your former landlady, Frau Staboy. She wants you to come over immediately. There's somebody waiting for you at her place. Hurry." He pulled on a pair of flannel trousers, and gasping for breath, went along the street. At this time of year in Berlin, there is something similar to the St. Petersburg white nights. The air was transparently gray, and the houses swam past like a soapy mirage. Some night workers had wrecked the pavement at the corner, and one had to creep through narrow passages between planks, everyone being given at the entrance a small lamp, which at the exit was to be left on a hook screwed into a post, or else simply on the sidewalk, next to some empty milk bottles. Leaving his bottle as well, he ran further through the lusterless streets, and the premonition of something incredible, of some impossible superhuman surprise, splashed his heart with a snowy mixture of happiness and horror. In the gray murk, blind children wearing dark spectacles came out of a school building in pairs and walked past him. They studied at night, in economically dark schools which in the daytime housed seeing children. And the clergyman accompanying them resembled the Leshino village schoolmaster, Bichkov. Leaning against a lamppost and hanging his tousled head, his scissor-like legs in striped pantaloons splayed wide and his hands stuffed in his pockets, a lean drunkard stood as if just come from the pages of an old Russian satirical rag. There was still light in the Russian bookstore. They were serving books to the night taxicab drivers, and through the yellow opacity of the glass he noticed the silhouette of Misha Berezovsky, who was handing out Petrie's Black Atlas to someone. Must be hard to work nights. Excitement lashed him again as soon as he reached his former haunts. He was out of breath from running, and the rolled-up lap robe weighed heavy on his arm. He had to hurry. But he could not recall the layout of the streets, and the ashy night confused everything, changing, as in a negative image, the relationship between dark and light parts. And there was no one to ask. Everybody was asleep. Suddenly, a poplar loomed, and behind it a tall church with a violet-red window divided into harlequin rhombuses of colored light. Inside, a night service was in progress, and an old lady in mourning, with cotton wool under the bridge of her spectacles, hastened to mount the steps. He found his street, but at the end of it, a post with a gauntleted hand on it indicated that one had to enter from the other end where the post office was, since at this end a pile of flags had been prepared for tomorrow's festivities. But he was afraid of losing it in the course of a detour, and moreover, the post office... that would come afterwards, if Mother had not already been sent a telegram. He scrambled over boards, boxes, and a toy grenadier in curls, and caught sight of the familiar house, and there the workmen had already stretched a red strip of carpet across the sidewalk from door to curb, as it used to be done in front of their house on the Neva embankment on ball nights. He ran up the stairs, and Frau Steboy immediately let him in. Her cheeks glowed, and she wore a white hospital overall. She had formerly practiced medicine. "Only don't get all worked up," she said. "Go to your room and wait there. You must be prepared for anything," she added with a vibrant note in her voice, and pushed him into the room which he had thought he would never in his life enter again. He grasped her by the elbow, losing control over himself, but she shook him off. "Somebody has come to see you," said Steboy. "He's resting. Wait a couple of minutes." The door banged shut. The room was exactly as if he had been still living in it. The same swans and lilies on the wallpaper. The same painted ceiling wonderfully ornamented with Tibetan butterflies. There, for example, was Thekla Baitai. Expectancy, awe, the frost of happiness, the surge of sobs merged into a single blinding agitation as he stood in the middle of the room incapable of movement, listening and looking at the door. He knew who would enter in a moment, and was amazed now that he had doubted this return. Doubt now seemed to him to be the obtuse obstinacy of one half-witted, the distrust of a barbarian, the self-satisfaction of an ignoramus. His heart was bursting, like that of a man before execution, but at the same time this execution was such a joy that life faded before it, and he was unable to understand the disgust he had been wont to experience when, in hastily constructed dreams, he had evoked what was now taking place in real life. Suddenly the door shuddered. Another remote one had opened somewhere beyond it, and he heard a familiar tread, an indoor Morocco-padded step. Noiselessly, but with terrible force, the door flew open, and on the threshold stood his father. He was wearing a gold-embroidered skullcap and a black cheviot jacket with breast pockets for cigarette case and magnifying glass. His brown cheeks, with their two sharp furrows running down from both sides of his nose, were particularly smoothly shaven. Hoary hairs gleamed in his dark beard like salt. Warmly, shaggily, his eyes laughed out of a network of wrinkles. But Fyodor stood and was unable to take a step. His father said something, but so quietly that it was impossible to make anything out, although one somehow knew it to be connected with his return, unharmed, whole, human, and real. And even so, it was terrible to come closer. So terrible that Fyodor felt he would die if the one who had entered should move toward him. Somewhere in the rear room sounded the warningly rapturous laughter of his mother, while his father made soft chucking sounds, hardly parting his lips, as he used to do when taking a decision or seeking something on the page of a book. Then he spoke again, and this again meant that everything was all right and simple, that this was the true resurrection, that it could not be otherwise, and also that he was pleased. Pleased with his captures, his return, his son's book about him. And then, at last, everything grew easy. A light broke through, and his father, with confident joy, spread out his arms. With a moan and a sob, Fyodor stepped toward him, and in the collective sensation of woolen jacket, big hands, and the tender prickle of trimmed moustaches, there swelled an ecstatically happy, living, enormous, paradisal warmth in which his icy heart melted and dissolved. At first, the superposition of a thingamy on a thingabob and the pale, palpitating stripe that went upwards were utterly incomprehensible, like words in a forgotten language, or the parts of a dismantled engine. And this senseless tangle sent a shiver of panic running through him. I have woken up in the grave, on the moon, in the dungeon of dingy non-being. But something in his brain turned, his thoughts settled, and hastened to paint over the truth. And he realized that he was looking at the curtain of a half-open window, at a table in front of the window. Such is the treaty with reason, the theater of earthly habit, the livery of temporary substance. He lowered his head onto the pillow and tried to overtake a fugitive sense, warm, wonderful, all-explaining. But the new dream he dreamt was an uninspired compilation stitched together out of remnants of daytime life and fitted to it. The morning was overcast and cool, with gray-black puddles on the yard's asphalt, and one could hear the nasty, flat thumping of carpets being beaten. The Shchogolevs had finished their packing. Zina had gone off to work, and at 1 o'clock was due to meet her mother for lunch at the Vaterland. Luckily, they had not suggested that Fyodor join them. On the contrary, Mariana Nikolaevna, as she warmed up some coffee for him in the kitchen where he sat in his dressing gown, disconcerted by the bivouac-like atmosphere in the apartment, warned him that a little Italian salad and some ham had been left in the larder for lunch. It turned out, incidentally, that the luckless person who was getting their number by mistake had rung up the previous night. This time he had been tremendously agitated. Something had happened, something which remained unknown. For the 10th time, Boris Ivanovich transferred from one valise to another a pair of shoes on shoe trees, all clean and shiny. He was unusually meticulous over footwear. Then they dressed and went out, while Fyodor shaved, carried out long and successful ablutions, and cut his toenails. It was especially pleasant to get under a tight corner and clip. The pairing shot all over the bathroom. The janitor knocked, but was unable to enter because the Shchogolevs had locked the hall door on the American lock, and Fyodor's keys had gone forever. Through the letterbox, clacking the shutter, the mailman threw in the Belgrade newspaper for Tsar and Church, to which Boris Ivanovich subscribed, and later someone thrust in, leaving it to stick out boat-like, a leaflet advertising a new hairdresser's. At exactly 11:30, there came a loud barking from the stairs and the agitated descent of the Alsatian, which was taken for a walk at this time. With a comb in his hand, he went out onto the balcony to see if the weather was clearing up. But although it did not rain, the sky remained hopelessly and wanly white, and one could not believe that yesterday it had been possible to lie in the forest. The Shchogolevs' bedroom was cluttered up with paper rubbish, and one of the suitcases was open. At the top, a pear-shaped object of rubber was lying on a wafer towel. An itinerant moustache came into the yard with cymbals, a drum, a saxophone, completely hung with metallic music, with bright music on his head and with a monkey in a red jersey, and sang for a long time, tapping his foot and jangling, without managing, however, to drown out the volleying at the carpets on their trestles. Cautiously pushing the door, Fyodor visited Zina's room, where he had never been before, and with the bizarre sensation of a glad moving in, he looked for a long time at the briskly ticking alarm clock, at the rose in a glass with its stem all studded with bubbles, at the divan that became a bed at night, and at the stockings drying on the radiator. He had a bite to eat, sat down at his desk, dipped his pen, and froze over a blank sheet. The Shchogolevs returned. The janitor came. Mariana Nikolaevna broke a bottle of scent, and he still sat over the glowering sheet, and only came to himself when the Shchogolevs were getting ready to go to the station. There were still 2 hours until the train's departure, but then the station was a long way off. "I must confess I like to get there on the cock," said Boris Ivanovich buoyantly as he took hold of his shirt cuff and sleeve in order to climb into his overcoat. Fyodor tried to help him, The other, with a polite exclamation, still only halfway in, shied away and suddenly in the corner turned into a horrible hunchback, and then went to say goodbye to Mariana Nikolaevna, who, with an oddly altered expression, as if she were dimming and coaxing her reflection, was in the act of putting on a blue hat with a blue veil before the wardrobe mirror. All at once, Fyodor felt strangely sorry for her, and after a moment's thought he offered to go to the stand for a taxi. "Yes, please," said Mariana Nikolaevna, and rushed ponderously to the sofa for her gloves. There proved to be no cabs at the stand. All had been taken, and he was forced to cross the square and look there. When he finally drove up to the house, the Shchogolevs were already standing below, having carried their suitcases down themselves. The heavy luggage had been dispatched the day before. "Well, God take care of you," said Mariana Nikolaevna, and kissed him with gutta-percha lips on the forehead. "Sarutska, Sarutska, send us a telegramotska," cried Boris the parodist, waving his hand, and the taxi turned and sped away. Forever, thought Fyodor with relief, and whistling went upstairs. Only here did he realize that he was unable to enter the apartment. It was particularly galling to raise the brass postal shutter and look through at a bunch of keys lying starwise on the hall floor. Mariana Nikolaevna had pushed them back in after locking the door behind her. He went down the stairs much more slowly than he had gone up. Zina, he knew, was planning to go from work to the station. Considering that the train would be leaving in about 2 hours and that the bus ride would take an hour, she and the keys would not be back in less than 3 hours. The streets were windy and gray. He had no one to go to, and he never went alone into pubs or cafes. He hated them fiercely. In his pocket there were 3.5 marks. He bought some cigarettes, and since the gnawing need to see Zina, now when everything was allowed, was really what was taking away all light and sense from the street, from the sky and the air, he hastened to the corner where the necessary bus stopped. The fact that he was wearing bedroom slippers and an ancient crumpled suit spotted in front, with trousers a button short on the fly, baggy knees, and a patch of his mother's making on the bottom, did not disturb him in the least. His tan and the open collar of his shirt gave him a certain pleasant immunity. It was some kind of a national holiday. 3 kinds of flags were sticking out of the house windows: black, yellow, red, black, white, red, and plain red. Each one meant something, and funniest of all, this something was able to excite pride or hatred in someone. There were large flags and small flags, on short poles and on long ones, but none of this exhibitionism of civic excitement made the city any more attractive. On the Tauentzienstrasse, the bus was held up by a gloomy procession. Policemen in black leggings brought up the rear in a slow truck, and among the banners there was one with a Russian inscription containing 2 mistakes, Sierb instead of Sierp, sickle, and Molt instead of Mollet, hammer. Suddenly he imagined official festivals in Russia, soldiers in long-skirted overcoats, the cult of firm jaws, a gigantic placard with a vociferous cliché clad in Lenin's jacket and cap. And amidst the thunder of stupidities, the kettle drums of boredom, and slave-pleasing splendors, a little squeak of cheap truth. There it is, eternalized, ever more monstrous in its heartiness, a repetition of the Hodinka coronation festivities with its free candy packages. Look at the size of them, now much bigger than the original ones, and with its superbly organized removal of dead bodies. Oh, let everything pass and be forgotten, and again in 200 years' time an ambitious failure will vent his frustration on the simpletons dreaming of a good life. That is, if there does not come my kingdom, where everyone keeps to himself, and there is no equality and no authorities. But if you don't want it, I don't insist and don't care. The Potsdam Square, always disfigured by city work. Oh, those old postcards of it, where everything is so spacious, with the droshky drivers looking so happy, and the trains of tight-belted ladies brushing the dust, but with the same fat flower girls. The pseudo-Parisian character of Unter den Linden, the narrowness of the commercial streets beyond it, bridge, barge, seagulls, the dead eyes of old hotels of the second, third, 100th class. A few more minutes of riding, and there was the station. He caught sight of Zena in a beige georgette dress and a white little hat running up the steps. She was running with her pink elbows pressed to her sides, holding her handbag under her arm. And when he caught up with her and half embraced her, she turned round with that tender, blurry smile, with that happy sadness in her eyes with which she always greeted him when they met alone. "Listen," she said in a flurried voice, "I'm late. Let's run." But he replied that he had already said goodbye to them and would wait for her outside. The low sun, settling behind the rooftops, seemed to have fallen out of the clouds that covered the rest of the sky. But they were by now quite soft and aloof, as if painted in melting undulations upon a greenish ceiling. There, in that narrow slit, the sky was on fire, and opposite, a window and some metallic letters shone like copper. A porter's long shadow, pushing the shadow of a barrow, sucked in that shadow, but at the turning it protruded again at a sharp angle. "We'll miss you, Zina," said Mariana Nikolaevna from the window of the carriage. "But in any case, take your vacation in August and come over. We'll see if you can't perhaps stay for good." "I don't think so," said Zina. "Ah, yes, I gave you my keys today. Don't take them with you, please. I left them in the hall, and Boris's are in the desk." "Never mind. Godunov will let you in," added Mariana Nikolaevna appeasingly. "Well, well, good luck to it," said Boris Ivanovich from behind his wife's plump shoulder and rolled his eyes. "Ah, Zinka, Zinka, just you come over and you shall ride a bicycle and swill milk. That's the life." The train gave a shudder and started to move. Mariana Nikolaevna kept waving for a long time. Shchogolev drew in his head like a tortoise, and having sat down, probably emitted a Russian grunt. She skipped down the steps. Her bag now hung from her fingers, and the last rays of the sun caused a bronze gleam to dance in her eyes as she flew up to Fyodor. They kissed as ardently as if she had just arrived from far off after a long separation. "And now let's go and have some supper," she said, taking his arm. "You must be starved." He nodded. Now how to explain it? Why this strange embarrassment, instead of the exultant, voluble freedom I had been so eagerly looking forward to? It was as if I had grown disused from her, or else was unable to adjust myself and her, the former her, to this freedom. "What's the matter with you? You seem out of sorts," she asked observantly after a silence. They were walking toward the bus stop. "It's sad to part with Boris the Brisk," he replied, trying to see if a joke would resolve his emotional constraint. "And I think it's yesterday's escapade," said Zina, smiling. And he detected in her tone of voice a high-strung ring, which in its own way corresponded to his own confusion, and thus both stressed and augmented it. "Oh, nonsense, the rain was warm. I feel wonderful." The bus rolled up. They boarded it. Fyodor paid for 2 tickets from his palm. Zina said, "I get my wages only tomorrow, so that all I have now is 2 marks. How much do you have?" "Very little. Out of your 200, I was left only 350, and more than half of that I've blowed." "We have enough for supper, though," said Zina. "Are you quite sure you like the idea of a restaurant? Because I don't too much." "Never mind. Resign yourself. In general, now it's all over with healthy home cooking. I can't even make an omelette. We must think about how to manage things. But for now, I know an excellent place." Several minutes of silence. The street lamps and shop windows were beginning to light up. The streets had grown pinched and gray from that immature light, but the sky was radiant and wide, and the sunset cloudlets were trimmed with flamingo down. Look, the photos are ready. He took them from her cold fingers. Zena standing in the street before her office, with legs placed tightly together in the shadow of a lime trunk crossing the sidewalk like a boom lowered in front of her. Zena sitting sideways on a windowsill with a crown of sunshine around her head. Zena at work, badly taken, dark-faced. But to compensate this, her regal typewriter enthroned in the foreground with a gleam on its carriage lever. She thrust them back in her bag, took out and put back her monthly tram ticket in its cellophane holder, took out a small mirror, looked into it, baring the filling in her front tooth, replaced the mirror inside, clicked the bag shut, lowered it onto her knees, looked at her shoulder, brushed off a bit of fluff, put on her gloves, turned her head to the window, doing all this in rapid succession, with her features in motion, her eyes blinking, and a kind of inner biting and sucking in of her cheeks. But now she sat motionless, looking away, the sinews in her pale neck stretched tight, and her white-gloved hands lying on the glossy leather of her handbag. The defilé of the Brandenburg Gate. Beyond the Potsdam Square, just as they were approaching the canal, an elderly lady with prominent cheekbones, where had I seen her, and with a goggle-eyed, trembling little dog under her arm, made a dive for the exit, swaying and struggling with phantoms, and Zena looked up at her with a fleeting, heavenly glance. "Did you recognize her?" she asked. "That was Lawrence. I think she's mad at me because I never ring her up. Quite a superfluous woman, really." "There's a smut on your cheek," said Fyodor. "Careful, don't smear it." Again the handbag, handkerchief, mirror. "We soon have to get out," she said presently. "What?" "Nothing, I agree. Let's get out where you like." "Here," she said two stops later, taking his elbow, sitting again from a jolt, rising finally and fishing out her bag as if from water. The lights had already taken shape. The sky was quite faint. A truck went by with a load of young people returning from some civic orgy, waving something or other and shouting something or other. In the middle of a treeless public garden consisting of a large oblong flower bed rimmed by a footpath, an army of roses was in bloom. The small, open enclosure of a restaurant, six little tables, opposite this garden, was separated from the sidewalk by a whitewashed barrier topped with petunias. Beside them, a boar and his sow were feeding. The waiter's black fingernail dipped into the sauce, and yesterday a lip with a sore on it had been pressed to the gold border of my beer glass. The mist of some sorrow had enveloped Zena. Her cheeks, her narrowed eyes, her throat pit, her fragile clavicle, and this was somehow enhanced by the pale smoke from her cigarette. The scuffing of passers-by seemed to stir up the thickening darkness. Suddenly, in the frank evening sky, very high, "Look," she said, "what a beauty!" A brooch with three rubies was gliding over the dark velvet, so high that not even the hum of the engine was audible. She smiled, parting her lips and looking upwards. "Tonight?" he asked, also looking upwards. Only now had he entered into the order of feelings he used to promise himself, when formerly he imagined how they would slip together out of a thraldom that had gradually asserted itself in the course of their meetings and grown habitual, even though it was based on something artificial, something unworthy, in fact, of the significance it had acquired. Now, it seemed incomprehensible why on any of those 455 days she and he had not simply moved out of the Shchogolev's apartment to dwell together. But at the same time, he knew subrationally that this external obstacle was merely a pretext, merely an ostentatious device on the part of fate, which had hastily put up the first barrier to come to hand in order to engage meantime in the important, complicated business that secretly required the very delay and development which had seemed to depend on a natural obstruction. Pondering now fate's methods, in this white illuminated little enclosure, in Zena's golden presence, and with the participation of the warm, concave darkness immediately behind the carved radiance of the petunias, he finally found a certain thread, a hidden spirit, a chess idea for his as-yet-hardly-planned novel, to which he had glancingly referred yesterday in the letter to his mother. It was of this that he spoke now, spoke in such a way as if it were really the best and most normal expression of his happiness, which was also expressed in a more accessible edition by such things as the velvetiness of the air, three emerald lime leaves that had got into the lamplight, the icy cold beer, the lunar volcanoes of mashed potato, vague voices, footfalls, the stars among the ruins of clouds. "Here is what I'd like to do," he said. "Something similar to destiny's work in regard to us. Think how fate started it 3.5 odd years ago. The first attempt to bring us together was crude and heavy. That moving of furniture, for example. I see something extravagant in it. A no-holds-barred something. Where it was quite a job moving the Lawrences and all their belongings into the house where I had just rented a room. The idea lacked subtlety. To have us meet through Lawrence's wife. Wishing to speed things up, fate brought in Romanov, who rang me up and invited me to a party at his place. But at this point, fate blundered. The medium chosen was wrong. I disliked the man, and a reverse result was achieved. Because of him, I began to avoid an acquaintance with the Lawrences, so that all this cumbersome construction went to the devil. Fate was left with a furniture van on her hands, and the expenses were not recovered." "Watch out," said Zina. "She might take offense at this criticism now and revenge herself." "Listen further. Fate made a second attempt, simpler this time, but promising better success, because I was in need of money and should have grasped at the offer of work, helping an unknown Russian girl to translate some documents. But this also failed. First, because the lawyer Charsky also turned out to be an unsuitable middleman, and secondly, because I hate working on translations into German, so that it again miscarried. Then, finally, after this failure, fate decided to take no chances, to install me directly in the place where you lived. As a go-between, she chose not the first person to come along, but someone I liked who energetically took the matter in hand and did not allow me to dodge it. At the last minute, true, there occurred a hitch that almost ruined everything. In her haste, or from stinginess, destiny did not produce you at the time of my visit. Of course, after talking 5 minutes to your stepfather, whom fate had been careless enough to let out of his cage, I decided not to take the unattractive room I had glimpsed over his shoulder. And then, at the end of her tether, unable to show me you immediately, fate showed me as a last desperate maneuver your bluish ball dress on the chair. And strange to say, I myself don't know why, but the maneuver worked. And I can imagine what a sigh of relief fate must have heaved. Only that wasn't my dress. It was my cousin Raisa's. She's very nice, but a perfect fright. I think she left it for me to take something off or sew something on. Then it was still more ingenious. What resourcefulness! The most enchanting things in nature and art are based on deception. Look, you see, it began with a reckless impetuosity and ended with the finest of finishing touches. Now, isn't that the plot for a remarkable novel? What a theme! But it must be built up, curtained, surrounded by dense life. My life, my professional passions and cares. Yes, but that will result in an autobiography with mass executions of good acquaintances. Well, let's suppose that I so shuffle, twist, mix, re-chew, and re-belch everything, add such spices of my own, and impregnate things so much with myself that nothing remains of the autobiography but dust. The kind of dust, of course, which makes the most orange of skies. And I shan't write it now. I'll be a long time preparing it, years, perhaps. In any case, I'll do something else first. I want to translate something in my own manner from an old French sage, in order to reach a final dictatorship over words, because in my Chernyshevsky they are still trying to vote. That's all marvelous, said Zina. I like it all immensely. I think you'll be such a writer as has never been before, and Russia will simply pine for you when she comes to her senses too late. But do you love me?" "What I'm saying is, in fact, a kind of declaration of love," replied Fyodor. "A kind of is not enough. You know, at times I shall probably be wildly unhappy with you, but on the whole it does not matter. I'm ready to face it." She smiled, opening her eyes wide and raising her eyebrows, and then she leaned slightly backwards in her chair and began to powder her chin and nose. I must tell you, this is magnificent. He has a famous passage which I think I can say by heart if I go right on, so don't interrupt me. It's an appropriate translation. There was once a man. He lived as a true Christian. He did much good, sometimes by word, sometimes by deed, and sometimes by silence. He observed the fasts. He drank the water of mountain valleys. That's good, isn't it? He nurtured the spirit of contemplation and vigilance. He lived a pure, difficult, wise life. But when he sensed the approach of death, instead of thinking about it, instead of tears of repentance and sorrowful partings, instead of monks and a notary in black, he invited guests to a feast. Acrobats, actors, poets, a crowd of dancing girls, three magicians, jolly Tollenburg students, a traveler from Taprobana, and in the midst of melodious verses, masks, and music, he drained a goblet of wine and died with a carefree smile on his face. Magnificent, isn't it? If I have to die one day, that's exactly how I'd like it to be. "Only minus the dancing girls," said Zeno. "Well, that's only a symbol of gay company. Perhaps now we can go?" "We have to pay," said Zeno. "Call him over." After this, they were left with 11 pfennigs, counting the blackened coin which she had picked up a day or two before from the sidewalk. It would bring luck. As they walked down the street, he felt a quick tremor along his spine, and again that emotional constraint, but now in a different, languorous form. It was a 20-minute slow walk to the house, and the air, the darkness, and the honeyed scent of blooming lindens caused a sucking ache at the base of the chest. This scent evanesced in the stretch from linden to linden, being replaced there by a black freshness, and then again beneath the next canopy an oppressive and heady cloud would accumulate, and Zena would say, tensing her nostrils, "Ah, smell it." And again the darkness would be drained of savor, and again would be heavy with honey. Will it really happen tonight? Will it really happen now? The weight and the threat of bliss. When I walk with you like this, ever so slowly, and hold you by the shoulder, everything slightly sways, my head hums, and I feel like dragging my feet. My left slipper falls off my heel. We crawl, dawdle, dwindle in a mist. Now we are almost all melted. And one day we shall recall all this. The lindens, and the shadow on the wall, and a poodle's unclipped claws tapping over the flagstones of the night. And the star. The star. And here is the square, and the dark church with the yellow light of its clock. And here on the corner, the house. Goodbye, my book. Like mortal eyes, imagined ones must close some day. Onegin from his knees will rise, but his creator strolls away. And yet the ear cannot right now part with the music and allow the tale to fade. The chords of fate itself continue to vibrate, and no obstruction for the sage exists where I have put the end. The shadows of my world extend beyond the skyline of the page, blue as tomorrow's morning haze, nor does this terminate the phrase. The end.